Thank you, Oscar, for inviting me to this. It's been really interesting to get this wide diversity of perspectives on climate change and how it will potentially affect plants as well as other things in the future. And so, as an evolutionary ecologist, a community biologist, I'm really interested in broad-scale patterns of diversity, and I'm going to talk about how we can kind of, we might try to predict future impacts of climate change on not just crops, but the entire flora of North America. As most of you probably know, climate is a major, it's a fundamental driver of species distributions, plant distributions. For instance, this is just a figure kind of illustrating, I'll try to use this mouse. Figure illustrating how biomes are defined by precipitation and average temperatures, and they also these variables also define the species that occur in these biomes. And so any shift in annual precipitation or average temperature is likely to affect not only the distribution of these biomes, but the species that live in them. And in fact, this has already started to happen. So historic climate change over the last century has already started to impact shifts in species ranges, plants, animals. And one of the best examples of this is in butterflies in Europe, where using historical records, they looked at butterfly distribution changes since the early 1900s, and they found two predominant flavors of response, and that is either a northward expansion, so occurrence of these butterflies in places they were not previously collected, or a southern truncation, so southern retraction. So this species used to occur there, but they no longer occur there. And these are common patterns not just in butterflies, but in plants. This just is a really good illustration of what we might expect under changing climate conditions. And so we saw this map with Massachusetts, but here's Vermont. And so in the future, you know, we're predicting major changes in the distribution of the climate and habitat. And so, you know, by the end of the century, under a high emission scenario, Vermont's supposed to be more like North Carolina than it is like anywhere else in New England. And that's dramatically going to impact the species that occur in that region. And this really forms the basis for what I'm going to be talking about in terms of predicting where we expect to find species in the future, moving forward with climate change. So one way to look at where species are going to move in response to climate change is to use what's called environmental niche modeling, and that's really just a way of taking distribution data, so where they live now, combining it with climate data, current climate data, or other environmental variables, and then building a model about where those species, where suitable habitat occurs across the landscape. And a recent study by the Audubon actually did this for most North American bird species, I think over a thousand, I don't know how many birds there are in North America. And this is just illustrating here the distribution of the summer range based on observed records for the ovenbird and the climate that's associated with those observations. So then you can project out on North America the general distribution of that bird. So the outline is the actual defined definition based on the Audubon's field guide, and then the kind of heat map or filled-in area is the model's estimation. And since this is based on climate, you can run these models forward under future climate scenarios, and so that looks like this. Whoops, does not look like that. So this is just running it from 2000 to 2080, and you can see that there's a significant shift in the distribution of suitable habitat for this bird. Now, I'm not naive. I know there's other factors that determine where a species lives, but what this is telling you is that the baseline factors, the baseline climatic factors that contribute to where the species lived are shifting. And so this really gives us a baseline estimate of how climate change will impact the species. It's not necessarily clear it can get to Alaska, or when it gets to Alaska, there'll be plants that it can survive on or species that might predate on it, but at the very least, we get an idea of how climate change will impact where this species can live on a baseline level. And so I wanted to do this for the North American flora, which is a substantially bigger project. There's about 21,000 species in the North American flora, and when we're talking about vascular plants, that includes angiosperms, gymnosperms, and ferns. Right now, we have sufficient distribution data to do the kind of niche modeling I'm talking about for about 12,000 species, which is about 60% of the North American flora. And this distribution data is based predominantly on museum specimen data, so herbarium records, but it includes other things too, like ecological plot data and Forest Service data. And then we're going to use these distribution data points to project these species distributions into the future in two time points, 2050 and 2070, across multiple climate models. And I'll go into detail a little bit more about that in a second. But so far, we haven't finished this project yet. We're in the middle of running these models now, but we have preliminary data for one major group, and that's what I'm going to talk about for the rest of my talk. And that group is the asters, so the sunflower family. And the sunflower family is actually a great case study for this because they're the most diverse family in the North American flora. But they also have significant, you know, benefits towards, they have significant implications for, you know, human interests. There are many cultivars that are asters. They're also well-known weedy species. And there's also agricultural implications in terms of food crops, but also major agricultural pests. So our data set consisted of about, we captured about 60% of the diversity of asters in North America. And when I say North America, I'm sorry, I'm limiting it to species that occur in the United States and Canada. Mexico has overlapping tropical ranges and increases it's a lot more difficult to get data for that part of North America. So I'm going to walk you through an example of how we do this niche modeling for a single species, just to kind of give you an idea of what I'm talking about. And that species is a New England aster. So here's the records of occurrence for the species. We had about 1,200 for the US and Canada. And then we combined these distribution data with a set of climatic variables taken from the BioClime data set and environmental layers that were taken include elevation and a series of soil characteristics. So the climate layers capture major axes of variation in temperature, temperature variation, precipitation, and precipitation variation. And I can go into more detail about that if you guys have questions. But combining the distribution data with these environmental layers, we're able to build a model of where you would expect to find suitable habitat for this species. And that's projected here in green as a heat map of suitability. And overlaid with the distribution data, you can see that the model does a fairly good job of predicting where you find suitable habitat for the New England aster. So that's based on present climate data. What does it look like when we map it onto future climate data? So to do that, we looked at a wide variety of climate models because there's a lot of variation. There's a lot of different scenarios in terms of what climate change is going to look like, and we wanted to capture that. So we looked across a set of different emission scenarios, from worst case scenario, or high emissions, that's business as usual, to the best case scenario, which probably isn't going to happen, but you know, it's good to be optimistic. And then we also looked at a bunch of climate models. So this is the present distribution of suitable habitat for the New England aster, like I just showed you. This is the centroid, the red dots, the centroid of that distribution. Let's project this into the future, into about 2050, the average climate at that time. Under a high emission scenario, you can see that the distribution of suitable habitat has shifted northward. And the red triangle represents the new centroid of that distribution. So this species is showing a northward shift in the distribution of suitable habitat. Will that species follow suit? We don't know. But it's definitely experiencing a degradation in its current distribution of suitable habitat. And so we can take these future projections and our present maps and calculate two aspects of change in suitability. The first one we wanted to really characterize was the net gain or loss of habitable area. So looking at the present distribution here in pink, subtracting it from the future distribution, how much did you lose or gain in overall habitat? And then the second thing we wanted to characterize was the loss of present habitat. So even if you might gain a significant amount of suitable area under future climate models, you might lose a lot of present distributions, and that has conservation implications. So with those variables in mind, we calculated them across the asters that we had data for. And just to kind of illustrate what those two variables look like, for the New England aster, here's under the high emissions model in 2050 on the left, you can see that the net gain is, I've mapped it out in green here as a heat map, and then the loss of present habitat, or the degradation of present habitat in terms of climate, is in pink. And while there's a net gain for the New England aster of about 10% in 2050, there's a loss of its present distribution of about 40%. In 2070, it's even more severe. It only gains about 10%, but it loses 60% of its present distribution. So that's a fairly, you know, significant effect of climate change, and not too distant future. And so what does it look like when we compare all asters? So this is low emissions on the left, high emissions on the right, and this is the distribution of all species for 2050 under one model, but the models are generally similar. And the range of net gain is about 10 to 15% of net increase in the distribution of suitable habitat. So for most aster species, climate change is, you know, increasing the is a good thing, or at least in terms of the availability of suitable habitat. In terms of the loss of the present distribution, however, you do see it. It's not as significant as the New England aster, but there is still a loss of present. There is going to be a degradation of the present climate habitat for most species, ranging between 9 and 12%. So, how do these species compare? If you take the things that are losing their present habitat versus the things that are gaining habitat under future climate conditions, it actually presents an interesting trade-off. So, net gain is on the y-axis and loss of present habitats on the x-axis. And this red line is kind of indicating where there's above the red lines a net gain and below the red lines a net loss. And the loss of present habitat, you can see starting around 40% of species are just generally losing. So these are kind of the losers under these climate change scenario conditions. But then on the other end of the distribution, these species aren't losing any present habitat and they're making significant gains under climate change, and these are really call them winners. Most species, like I said, are gaining, but these species are gaining an exceptional amount. So who are these winners and losers? Just to kind of a preliminary look, it will give us some, has conservation implications, because it turns out when we look at who those species are and those tail ends of the distribution, the winners range between 12 and 18 different species, depending on the model and the emission scenario, but they're actually species with relatively small current distributions, and all of them are recognized to be endangered or threatened either by state or federal governments. So these, whereas in contrast, these losers, which are a lot more, but are also recognized to have be endangered or threatened species by state and local governments. So there's a trade-off between which species might be worth focusing on for conservation efforts. Since we're in an agricultural conference, I thought it'd be interesting to pull out a couple agricultural weeds and see how they did under these models. The Canadian thistle is the first one I looked at, and this is the net gain and loss. This kind of represents the range of variation under different models, and this is the present loss. So the Canadian thistle, interestingly, is expected to gain a lot in terms of climate change, anywhere from, by 2050, anywhere between 10 to 20% increase in the overall suitability for this species, but it's also expected to lose a lot of this present distribution between 5 and 20%, and this is the distribution of those gains and losses. So there's going to be a significant degradation in the U.S., but a significant increase in suitability in Canada. And this is in contrast to another common agricultural weed, the common sunflower, which is expected to do very well under climate change in terms of the availability of suitable habitat, but doesn't really experience any loss in its present distribution. So this is just experiencing a gangbuster northward expansion into Canada. So what about all of the species together when we kind of map them out on the North American landscape? Where are they moving? The species I showed you all kind of exhibit this northward expansion, but when we look at the distribution of species over the entire range, you can see that I've color-coded the centroids of their distributions here, as blue is shifting northward and red is shifting south. And the predominant pattern is a northward expansion or northward shift in these species, with a couple of interesting regional exceptions. So when you zoom in on the southwest, or the west really, and or the southeast, you see that, well, there might be slight north or south trend in the distribution of these species. It's really an eastward shift, and what underlies that we're not entirely sure yet, but we're looking into it. But it might have a lot to do with changes in precipitation patterns. What about diversity? As a community ecologist and someone interested in biodiversity, I'm interested in how these shifts are likely to affect overall patterns of diversity. And so for the asters, here's a map of the distribution, a heat map of diversity for asters across North America under present conditions. And then this is what it looks like if we take our distribution models and calculate the same diversity levels in the future. You can kind of see that there's a northward expansion. And in fact, when you calculate the centers of diversity for the present versus the future, you can see that there's about a 450-kilometer shift. And, well, that's kind of abstract. It actually has important implication in terms of not only where these species are going to live, but with how these are the interactions these species are going to experience, not only with other asters, but with other plants and other second-order interactions with herbivores and pathogens. So this is really interesting because we're opening the door to a whole new world of world of communities that don't exist in the current matrix of communities that we know. And so that's something I'm really excited to explore as we move forward with this project. So just to kind of summarize, most asters will gain suitable habitat. Rare vulnerable asters will become more vulnerable, with some exceptions. Some rare asters might actually benefit with increased climate change. Suitable habitat for major agricultural weeds, at least two, is going to expand under future climate models. And like I said, most asters are going to exhibit this northward push into Canada, with some regional exceptions that we need to look into. And just to touch on a few future directions, so I mentioned we're just looking at one family in the flora of North America. We, like I said, we want to expand this out to really look at as many species as we can. And then what I'm really interested in is how are these projected shifts going to interact with land use in terms of affecting migration routes? Because I mentioned earlier that these are just projections of suitability, not projections of where these species are going to occur. And so it's really it's not just a matter of can you live there in the future, it's a matter of can you get there in the future. And combining land use maps with dispersal ability and other characteristics of the plant, we'll be able to calculate, you know, potential migration corridors across the landscape. And with that, I'll end and acknowledge everyone, all of my collaborators, and thank you guys. Yeah, absolutely. That's once we kind of generate this full data set, that's going to be one of the first questions we're really going to be interested in looking at. Because invasives have shown, especially certain invasives have shown a dramatic ability to kind of expand their range. And I'm an evolutionary biologist, so I'm really interested in range evolution. So kind of getting at the fundamentals of that will be something that will be fun to look at. I think you have to wait for the microphone. Sorry.
I have two questions. First, how do you interplay the changing climate with latitude versus elevation? And if that can explain your Eastern movement, is it not just looking how question, I might have just missed it, but how you dealt with difference in plasticity between different species, like if plasticity comes to your models, and how you dealt with that with some species being dead, with how you talked about the vulnerable, more vulnerable species, ones that are less plastic and more plastic, and their change in greenish.
Yeah. So for the first one, elevation, concerns of elevation, that's, we include elevation as a factor in our model. To what extent it drives a species distribution, you know, it depends on the species, I guess. But I think that pattern, especially out west, is one of species moving eastward up potentially mountains. It's going to be some, like I said, we have to kind of get into the nitty-gritty of how elevation versus precipitation influences these distributions. The second one, this model does not include plasticity beyond just capturing the innate variation of a species distribution. Plasticity is a major component for how species are going to adapt to climate change. And not just plasticity, but adaptation, the ability for species to kind of sit in place and just shift when they flower or live, like Amanda mentioned earlier with phenology changes. And there are models that incorporate that, and that's something we really want to get into. It's just that there's actually not very much information on the phenology of most species. So we're actually tackling that from a different angle using herbarium records and trying to capture phenological sensitivity. But yeah, it's definitely something that we want to get at. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you expand on why wheat will adapt better than other species?
So the difference between those two weeds, I don't really have a good explanation for because I just pulled them out the other day. But I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that most weeds are widely distributed, right? And so that means that they can occur in a wide degree of climate environments. And so they just naturally expand. They can expand into new climate, opening climate regions as they just kind of open up as you go northward, if that makes sense. So, okay. Yeah, thanks.